Welcome back to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer. Our rural healthcare discussion will conclude with questions from the audience. The panel was moderated by WBOI News Director Rebecca Green, and the first question will be answered by Doug Powers from Beckman Lawson in Fort Wayne. Please enjoy the discussion.
I have a couple questions, and you may not want to answer them all, but I was struck when you talked about the per capita cost in our country versus others. I just looked today, World Health Organization puts us at about 37th in terms of healthcare indicators. So, you know, we're not getting what we pay for if we're really looking at quality. So that was just one point, and you can speak to that. Before the ACA, in the discussions before the ACA became law, the Institute of Medicine was saying that conservatively, the estimate was that lack of access cost 45,000 deaths a year. And so I'm curious about whether we can tie deaths in Northeast Indiana or rural areas to lack of access. And then just one more point, and I'd love to hear your question. I've been really impacted by a film a couple years ago, Fix It. Healthcare at a tipping point, and it makes the business case for universal healthcare by saying, because employers have gotten tied into this crazy system of providing health insurance, we're less competitive in the world market. So any one of those things, I'd love to hear any of you talk about.
Well, I'll just make a comment on the what already has been mentioned is the horrible inefficiencies of the system. There are just too many tin cups that dip into the stream from beginning to end. And if we had a more direct route, like you're describing that you have here with direct care and essentially a capitated system, you cut out all those tin cups and you get greater value for your money. I happen to think, I've heard of the direct care kind of model where there's no insurance company at all, and my guess is that you're able to be much more efficient and cost-effective for your patients. But it's such a tangled system right now, and single payer got a little bit of legs in 2009 as we were going through the initial stages of the healthcare debate, but it got too much resistance, and so what we went to was more of a collaborative model where we got all the constituencies involved, including providers, including hospitals, including insurers, and we all tried to figure out a way where we could get some kind of system that would be better, but we still had all those components and therefore a lot of these inefficiencies. One of the primary goals of the ACA, as I mentioned earlier, affordability, access, and quality. And the quality measure is such a critical piece, but we have so many impediments that keep us from getting there because of the tin cup syndrome.
I think we have a good foundation now since we're talking about solutions, whether it's for those who live in rural areas, central urban areas, or suburbs, wherever it might be. We have a good foundation now with regard to our current, quote, single-payer system. It's not a dirty word to me. It makes total sense. Medicare, the government acts as the insurance agency. All the care is delivered by the private sector, private hospitals, private docs offices, perhaps nurse practitioners, physical therapy, laboratory, whatever it is. We have that structure there in place right now. I think it's a good foundation on which to build. So I'm going to go out on a limb and say one good way to do it, and if a single payer has been made a dirty word, we'll just drop it and use some other word. but to take current Medicare and, for instance, start gradually expanding current Medicare to cover other segments of the population, maybe rural population should be one of the first areas that would be covered under a gradual Medicare expansion. And there's no question that we need somehow to make sure 100% of all Americans, not even the 90% that are insured with the addition of the Affordable Care Act, 100% are covered. And I think there's no question that basically thousands of people are dying in the U.S. because they don't have decent health insurance. I want to tell you a quick story of a gentleman I took care of once. He was actually from Huntington County. He was sent to me. He was in dire straits, came into an emergency room in a Fort Wayne hospital at 3 in the morning. He had a temperature of 104 for a week. He said he worked. He had employment but no insurance. He said, you know, I had pain in my chest and a cough and had some fever a week ago, and I took some of my daughter's old penicillin from the shelf. I was scared to go to the doc because I was afraid I was going to land in the hospital and end up with a big hospital bill and was going to bankrupt me and that somebody was going to take my house. And therefore, I took my daughter's penicillin, toughed it out. He lived like 3 hours after he arrived at the hospital. Well, he was one of those conservatively, you know, 20, 30, 40,000 people in the U.S. who die. And they could go get health care, but they know when they do, they're running the risk of financial catastrophe. So they make a gamble, which often does pay off, actually, but for the 40,000 or so like this gentleman, it doesn't pay off. I think it's a totally unethical, immoral situation in our country, and I think we need to solve it.
I think as long as we have a medical delivery system that is, to some extent, built on a profit motive, we're in big trouble, because if you have a capitalist model like that, where you theoretically have two parties who are bargaining for services, I can't imagine a situation with more unequal bargaining power than an individual who's been in a car accident, and here comes the helicopter. He says, I'm going to save your life, and it's going to cost you $35,000 to go from here to the hospital. You are in no position in that circumstance to bargain about anything. Or even if it's an elective situation, try and find out what the cost is going to be in advance. It's impossible. You can't do it. What would help, and I think what moves us toward a single-payer type of situation, is you more or less are able to equalize that bargaining power, because you have a really big party on the other side of that table in the form of either some governmental entity or the federal government. Somebody who can dictate and say, you know what, this is what I'm going to pay you. You're not going to demand what you're going to get from me.
Well, I think the standard equation is, oh my gosh, we can't have a single payer system because our taxes will go through the roof because our healthcare system is so expensive. That's why it's so important for Americans to realize how much money they're paying into the system that doesn't have anything to do with actually obtaining healthcare. So if you're working, you're paying your Medicaid taxes, so you're supporting everyone over 65 and disabled. You're paying your Medicare taxes, and then Medicaid taxes to take care of all the poor people. You're paying your own personal premiums. You don't see that. Your employer pays it for you. But it's about $8,000 a year for a single, $15,000 a year for a family. So whatever you're making, if you're getting family insurance through your employer, there's $15,000 that goes off to the insurance company to give you co-pays and deductibles and networks and confusion. And then, of course, when you need care, then you have high deductible plans. So when people talk about switching to single payer, the idea is to get rid of all that excess bureaucracy and all the bureaucracy that hospitals deal with in terms of billing and collections, all the different payers, all the craziness that doctors have to deal with in terms of all the confusing paperwork. That's real money. And so when that disappears in a single payer system, when you eliminate all the executive salaries and advertising and underwriters, and you begin to do things like bargain over drug prices or set fixed prices that everyone can agree, all these other developed countries, they come up with a price that allows the medical system to function, but it's not some crazy splay of prices like we have in America. And all of those things result in a lot of savings. And the study suggests that probably 95% of Americans, if we switch to a single payer system, would actually have more take home money, because you wouldn't be paying all this extra money for bureaucracy and insurance premiums. And again, I've given up trying to convince people of this. What I really would dearly love is if we could have single payer discussed in a rational way, you know, not have someone say, oh, you don't want a government takeover of healthcare, and then tell a couple of anecdotes about Canada. I really wish we could look at all the different countries in the world and at least have an honest discussion about the possibility of single payer, because I think we're all losing when we don't do that.
We've kind of focused on a government solution to this problem. Is there realistically a potential marketplace solution to this problem or not?
My answer would be, what has the marketplace done for us so far? As it's been pointed out, our costs are going up and up and up. People are having to struggle with these high deductible healthcare plans. I'm not convinced that there's any data that suggests the market system that we have has actually been able to control the cost curve or ensure better care for all of us. Now, he suggested one approach. I think all this stuff should be on the table. But I think to argue that the marketplace should be able to do things and solve the problem, I think that train left a while ago. And I would add to that that it's important to understand that the ACA really was corporate welfare. It was billed as a government takeover of healthcare, but it was actually a corporate takeover of a government's attempt to provide more insurance. All of the subsidies and the exchanges, that's all taxpayers paying to create a marketplace that benefits for the insurance companies. Remember, the insurance companies even had the option of extracting money from the government if they didn't make enough money. And that's the really amusing thing is how the Republicans are trying to shut that down, which is, you know, kind of biting the lobbyists that have been feeding them. That doesn't mean the ACA isn't a brilliant law, given the fact that it had to work within the confines of our crazy system. And it doesn't mean there aren't good things in the ACA, but it's really important to understand that was big business writing a law to benefit them, not necessarily us.
You know, I just go back to a simple concept of bargaining power, and it doesn't have to be the government. Government's a big player, so certainly they would be in the mix in terms of bargaining with these mega healthcare systems. But it was within the past year, I think, that Berkshire Hathaway, Amazon, and J.P. Morgan all decided they would get together, and they try and come up with their very own system for their own employees. Now, those are big players. My guess is they have a fair amount of bargaining power. It's a little bit scary to think about, you know, the concentration in the corporate world where you have very, you know, fewer controls, but you got to have somebody who can talk to a hospital and be able to do so meaningfully in a way that drives down costs.
For people who live in rural communities or people who are at the lower end of the wage scale, like the gentleman you described from Huntington, if you could each identify one thing we can do or others can do to improve their access or their health care. Dr. Tom?
Yeah, I'll come up with one, and that is something that's done around the world. Can't help but think about Costa Rica. It's kind of amazing. Of course, we provide military support for them, so they don't have to spend any money on the military, so they have more to spend on health care. But there, I actually know some folks that used to be Hoosiers who live in Costa Rica, and sure enough, every 6 months, the healthcare worker stops by, checks their blood pressure, maybe screens them for diabetes, talks to them about are you getting your XYZ prescription filled, everything going okay there. I mean, especially for rural areas where mechanically it's often difficult for somebody in, thinking about Northeast Indiana, who lives 10 or 15 miles from Huntington or Columbia City or Warsaw, to have individuals go to the homes of individuals, especially at-risk individuals, and take some, for instance, give them a flu shot in their home, check their blood pressure, make sure they're straight on their meds. A lot of private health insurance companies do this already because they know that it makes sense. And if people, for instance, who have diabetes do the things they need to do, they're going to have fewer complications, they're going to live longer. But it's generally very much a common sense thing that I think would be excellent for rural areas, especially where individuals have physical difficulty getting to a healthcare source. Let's have more outreach. I think it can be very beneficial.
I have a pretty fundamental suggestion, and that is money. I'm not sure how accurate this is, but I think the average medical school debt when somebody's finished is well over $200,000. It's not any different in the legal profession. There are a lot of lawyers who want to do public interest work. They come out with this huge amount of debt, and they can't afford to take that. So we've got to find ways to incentivize higher pay for primary care docs or figure out a way to lessen that debt burden so we get them to choose to work where we really need them out in these rural areas.
I don't think there's an answer. I think rural people are sunk, as are poor people. They have no political voice. No one's in the emergency room seeing who couldn't afford their blood pressure medicine, and they got a stroke and a heart attack. And Sherry mentioned the outcomes, America's results in terms of quality and results. It turns out that if you're in the top 40% of wage earners for men and the top 20% of wage earners for women, you're probably going to get pretty good health care. Your results are probably going to be similar to some of the other developed countries. So anyone less than those amounts is not likely to get good results, but no one's paying attention to them. And of course, they have no political clout. I think one thing might be for people to realize that for every child that goes sick in a rural county, for every person that can't get the mental health care they need, that's going to turn into a lot more cost that the rest of us are going to have to pay. When we decide to not care for our fellow citizens, we pay for it because they come in sicker, there's less productivity. When we decide to not pay for our fellow citizens because they're in the emergency room, like Tom's patient, tying up resources, we and our families are more likely to be at risk. And I think when people that don't think in those terms realize that they're risking their family, their income, their money, maybe they'll start to realize that we should actually take care of these people as though they were our family.
Anything else you guys would like to add this evening as kind of wrap up, Dr. Tom?
This isn't really a wrap up, but a happy story. Another one that a gentleman I was involved with came to the multi-county medical outreach clinic there in Columbia City, and he said, hey, I have an employer, he wants to hire me, he'll even provide health insurance on the job, but I have a hernia and I can't afford whatever it is. I have no insurance, I can't really afford to get this hernia taken care of. So we talked with Whitley County Hospital, actually Mount Parkview Whitley, and also a surgeon on the staff there who's actually been one of our volunteer docs, is where volunteer driven. He said he negotiated the deal for the space, his surgery, $150 or $200 to fix this gentleman's hernia, and went and got a job and got health insurance. So, but that's still a patchwork approach. We need a broader solution, and rather than just demonizing the new term, single payer, whatever it might be, we need to have our leaders, even if they can figure a private sector way to do it, fine. We need to have our leaders on a national scale come up with a solution for this catastrophic problem. It's immoral. It's a terrible blight on our nation. And I think our leaders need to stop talking about it and really get it done. By the way, one other thing that can be done, that is done, and I think Medicaid may be backing off on this, is to provide transportation to healthcare delivery sites. This is especially a rural matter, not just rural, but we're talking about rural primarily tonight, rural healthcare a bit. If there was just more basic transportation to get individuals from out in rural, for instance, Kosciuszko County, to a primary care physician slash nurse practitioner who's in Warsaw, for instance, that would that be a huge step forward. I think there are problems right now with regard to transportation costs by Medicaid. Rebecca?
CMS is writing a rule that would prevent non-emergent transportation to physicians. So if you are bedbound and you need to go to a doctor's appointment, but it's not an emergency, they're not going to pay for it. So if you need an ambulance, you're going to pay for it. Doctors Walker and Tom Hayhurst and Doug Powers, thank you guys so much for your knowledge, for your expertise, and your compassion this evening. It's been a great conversation, and I look forward to continuing it maybe online. So thank you all. You have a great evening. Thanks for coming out to WBY Issues and Nails.
Thank you. Thank you, Rebecca. Thank
you. This has been an episode of WBOI Presents. Special thanks to Greg Case for running sound at Joseph DeQuise. Next week, we will bring you excerpts from Indiana Tech's Tech Talk series, addressing the opioid crisis. Our theme music is by Mark Waldick. Additional music is by Mark Waldick and Noah Campodonico. Folktales is next. Have a wonderful night.